It is Monday, January the 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, another Middle East peace conference without much progress.
There's not much movement. There's not much change in it. And I don't expect that there will be much change in the coming days.
Inaugurating a new U.S. president, some famous words from a renowned civil rights leader.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed.
Also ahead, the death of a famous photographer.
Well, the conference is just basically a reflection, a rubber stamp.
Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Some 70 countries have reaffirmed that only a two-state solution could resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and warned against any unilateral steps by either side that could prejudge negotiations. All of that happened at a one-day international Middle East peace conference in Paris. VOA's Victor Beatty asked American University Professor Emeritus and Middle East scholar Russell Stone for his thoughts on the Paris meeting.
Well, the conference is just basically a reflection, a rubber stamp of the United Nations Security Council resolution of recent days. It didn't take any new action and is not expected to result in any new measures either in the United Nations or elsewhere in the world at this point.
This comes just 5 days before a new U.S. president is sworn into office.
The Israeli Prime Minister pointed that out in his news conference, where he said that an old world is ending and a new world is coming. He's expecting that there will be a new American foreign policy and that it will be much more favorable to his government's interests. It's not likely that the rest of the world will change in any way, however.
Israel had expressed concern that whatever came out of this conference would be in the form of yet a new U.N. Security Council resolution.
There was relief among Israeli journalists that that didn't appear to be happening.
Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas said Saturday that moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, as President-elect Trump has indicated he may want to do, would kill off the peace process. He said the Paris meeting would help at stopping settlement activities and destroying the two-state solution through dictations and use of force.
Well, the conference doesn't appear to have done what President Abbas wished. It made no mention of the plan to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. There was apparently a great deal of discussion of that at the conference, and U.S. Secretary Kerry took steps to make sure that that would not be a part of any resolution or statement that came out of the Paris meeting.
Well, where do we stand now in the Mideast peace process, in your view?
Where we stood before, there's not much movement, there's not much change in it. And I don't expect that there will be much change in the coming days. There will be controversy over the question of moving the embassy, but even if it is moved, or regardless of how those discussions go, the actual process of moving toward a peace agreement is not moving.
Based upon any testimony you may have heard from any of the cabinet nominees of the incoming Trump administration, do you get a sense as to where the U.S. will come down on the Israeli-Palestinian dispute?
I don't think that's clear within the new administration. The hearings last week highlighted the fact that many of the candidates differ from Trump's statements in what they're willing to advocate, but I don't think they've clarified their stand on it, nor has it been the subject of a clear decision among the new leadership.
Russell Stone is a professor emeritus and expert on the Middle East at American University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty.
On Friday, January 20th, the 45th President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, will be sworn into office. VOA will be there and will broadcast the presidential inauguration live from 1600 UTC to 1800 UTC to audiences around the world. Tune in as we begin the next chapter in American history, right here on VOA.
Well, as we just heard, Mr. Trump will be sworn in later in the week, and since his election in November, Donald Trump has been selecting nominees to fill top government posts to help lead his business-friendly agenda. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman has been watching the confirmation process and shares his observations with my colleague Jim Stevenson.
Well, Jim, you can tell that a presidential inauguration is just around the corner. Voice of America, our building, is just across the street from the National Mall, where President-elect Trump will become President Trump on Friday. And the big question is, how much of his team is going to be confirmed and in place and ready to serve alongside him in his inner circle when he enters the White House on Friday?
Republican lawmakers have indicated that they do want to get as many people in place as possible, but, you know, it is a procedure.
Even the most partisan Democrats don't want Donald Trump to be going into the White House with no one at his side. However, there is a strong partisan bent, obviously, when it comes to any sort of confirmations process. And we can already see certain things developing. I don't think that Rex Tillerson, who was tapped to be Secretary of State, is going to get a single Democratic vote in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which is handling his nomination. And Republicans have a one-seat majority on that committee. So if any Republican comes out in opposition to Rex Tillerson, that means that his nomination would not come out of committee with its approval. It could potentially be brought to the floor anyway. But typically, a nominee who doesn't make it out of committee does not end up serving in the U.S. government. And the question right now is, who might oppose him on the Republican side? On the whole, Jim, I think that Republicans have been very pleased with the choices that Donald Trump has made. Republicans and Democrats are very much in favor of retired General James Mattis to lead the Pentagon. I suspect that Representative Mike Pompeo, who is on the House Intelligence Committee, is going to be confirmed easily to be CIA director. But there are a few where there are some question marks. I mean, Ben Carson for the Department of Housing and Urban Development really didn't do himself any favor with some rambling and bumbling answers that he gave in committee last week. There are certain nominees that will probably sail through, but there are others where, honestly, from my perch in the Senate, I just cannot say how it's going to proceed.
During the campaign, Donald Trump was very adamant at saying that he would bring in the best and the brightest to lead government. He promised to, quote, drain the swamp. And we've seen some strong nominees, but not necessarily draining the swamp or getting rid of the establishment.
I think this is going to be a fascinating sort of experiment. I mean, here we have an incoming president who was elected with a lot of votes from Joe Sixpack types and who is filling out his cabinet with a lot of exceedingly wealthy tycoon types, people who are at the top of their profession within the business world. The one thing that I've heard from analysts is this. If you are the CEO of ExxonMobil, or you are a general or a retired general, you are very accustomed to whatever you say gets done immediately or heads roll. That's really not the way things work in the American federal bureaucracy. Agency heads have a great deal of power, but they don't snap their fingers and have things get done. Congress is always involved. Things get bogged down. There are funding questions. There are legal questions and all kinds of paperwork. And let's be honest, as anyone who works for a federal agency knows, the wheels of our government can turn very slowly indeed. It really remains to be seen whether the business culture will really mesh well with a sort of government bureaucracy. I'm as curious as anyone to see just how that works out.
From his perch on the Hill is Michael Bowman. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman there speaking with my colleague Jim Stevenson. Well, as they've been saying, for the first time in a number of years, Congress and the White House will be in the hands of the Republican Party come January 20th. As for what the political climate here in Washington might be like this year, we've just had a possible indicator. Last week, lawmakers began the process of repealing the Affordable Care Act, often referred to as Obamacare. Mr. Trump had campaigned for president on the promise that he would do away with Obamacare. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with two political experts. John Fortier is director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Igor Volsky is deputy director of the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Carol begins their discussion by asking Fortier for his read on how the new Congress will go forward in dealing with Mr. Trump's agenda.
I do think you see Donald Trump obviously is going to be a different kind of president. All of the characteristics during the campaign haven't disappeared. But there have been some ways in which I think he has become a more traditional figure, at least in part. Many of the nominees that he has picked that are going forward, they're not probably so different than a typical Republican nominee would have. So the process has seemed a bit crazy. We're all watching Trump Tower to see who shows up in the lobby. But at the end of the day, the nominees, I think, are people who look something like more traditional Republicans. Similarly with Congress, there still are dissenters and people who are not in the Republican Party who are not thrilled with Donald Trump. But I think most of Congress has accepted this surprising result in the election as an opportunity to move forward on the Republican agenda. And there will be significant differences about details, but big picture, both the president and Republicans in Congress want to accomplish the difficult task of repealing Obamacare and the more difficult task of replacing it. Donald Trump has held to his guns to say that he wants to get the wall going, starting work on border security, on immigration. And I think you'll see also with the Supreme Court nominee and other things coming up that Republicans can't agree on, even though they're difficult to do, will be things that are on the agenda early on.
Turning to you, Igor, for your take on what we're liable to look forward to, do you agree with John that on the big picture, at least the Republican-controlled Congress is in sync with President-elect Trump, but perhaps differ on the details? How do you see things?
No, and I don't envy John. I think he's going to have a difficult position in the next 4 years trying to bring some sanity or see some sanity in what's going to be happening with this administration, this Congress. But they're totally out of sync. So you take an issue like Obamacare, for instance. Yes, there's agreement. They all want to get rid of it. They do not want to replace it. If they wanted to replace it, they would have had a plan to actually replace it. They have no plan. You have the president-elect saying in his first press conference that you mentioned that they're going to do this at the same time. You have congressional leaders saying, well, no, we're going to first repeal it. Then maybe in 2-3 years, we'll replace it with something else. So there's no agreement at all. And that's really a key promise where there should be agreement of if you ran on this idea and you got votes because of this idea, they should actually have a plan. There is no plan. And, you know, that's going to be really challenging to deliver on something they promised to do on day one. They have absolutely no way at all of doing that.
Well, back to you, John Fortier. Any other legislative priorities you want to underscore to look forward to?
Well, just to focus on Obamacare for a minute, I think that is going to be the thing that we are talking about the most in the first couple of months. And I at least go a ways down where the direction that Igor is going in, that it is difficult and Republicans have not coalesced around a replacement. And there's the difficulty of not only the replacement, but a transition period, that there are people who are relying on what is in place now and they will need some time to transition out of. That being said, I think there actually are a lot of plans. There's not a plan, and those plans are not so dissimilar, and that Republicans are, you know, it's in their interest to come around and find something. You know, you see the outlines of what that might be, and it will take a while, and it will be controversial, but I guess I think, you know, Republicans, again, have seen this as a gift to have all the levers of power. And the biggest thing they have promised and wanted to say is that they've moved away from Obamacare and moved to something else. I'm not as cynical as some who say they just will replace Obamacare with another Obamacare, but they clearly are going to have to retain some elements. They're not going to do everything they wanted to do. The money isn't necessarily there, but I think the opportunities are there for them to come to some agreement.
Back to you, Igor Volsky. Through the lens of Obamacare, let's talk about the role of the Democrats who are now in the minority in all branches of government. We have a new Senate Minority Leader, Chuck Schumer. Bit of a different style from his predecessor, Harry Reid. Talk about what the Democrats' role will be in this Congress, whether it's vis-a-vis Obamacare, either pushing back, trying to retain elements of Obamacare that are good. How do you see them either fighting back or pushing back?
Well, I think it's been heartening to a lot of people to see the Senate Minority Leader really stand firm on not negotiating, for instance, with Republicans when they work on their replacement, whatever that replacement will look like, sending the message that if you break it, you own it. And I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of work, certainly in the Congress and outside outside of the Congress from progressive groups to ensure that the Democrats really stand firm in opposing the regressive Trump agenda when it comes to, of course, the health care law and across the board, but also put forward big, bold, progressive solutions, which I think John actually may agree with me here. You look at the polling numbers and on the actual policies, the most popular Trump policy was actually protecting Medicare and Social Security from any kinds of changes. Trump ran on it, and you look at the numbers, that was the most popular thing that Trump said in terms of policy. And you actually go all the way down in terms of policy background checks, for instance. 89% of Trump voters want to see background checks.
So for,
for gun purchases in America. So when you look at what voters actually supported in terms of how what the government does impacts their lives, I would say that they are on board with a far more progressive agenda than they are with the kind of trickle-down approach that conservative Republicans take to economics.
If I could jump in, I guess I don't think we're going in the direction that Igor mentioned, but I do think there's some Trump things that are not traditionally Republican, and those with some extra spending, either on infrastructure or just the willingness to not make deficits as high a priority. Even the Freedom Caucus and others in Congress have essentially agreed that maybe with a Trump presidency, they will ease off a little bit on their fiscal conservatism. So I think you will see some movement in a direction that you might not have seen from a more traditional Republican candidate.
That is John Fortier. He is director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center. He and Igor Volsky, deputy director at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, spoke with my colleague, Carol Castiel. She is host of the VOA program Encounter. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA. A leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Salih saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, today is a federal holiday here in the United States. It is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It remembers a man who was the chief spokesman for nonviolent activism in the civil rights movement, which successfully protested racial discrimination in federal and state law. Dr. King is well remembered also for a speech he gave here in Washington in 1963. It was delivered during the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, in which he called for an end to racism.
Even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream.
And his speech went on to say so many things that he dreamed about, and they, many of them have come to be. Anyway, the campaign for the federal holiday in Dr. King's honor began soon after he was assassinated. That happened in 1968. A few years later, actually in 1983, President Ronald Reagan signed the holiday into law. It is time now to step aside, do other things, and talk about what's trending on social media. G. Abby Lee is here. Hey, G., what's happening?
Hello, Steve. Across the country, thousands have gathered to rally for the continuation of the Affordable Care Act, widely known as the Obamacare. The rallies are called Our First Stand, and judging from the photos popping up on Twitter and Instagram, they are big in Maine, Indiana, and Texas. The nation's capital, where we are, is also seeing the rally. One of the tweets from Washington, D.C. is a photo of Senator Tim Kaine defending the ACA to hundreds on Capitol Hill.
You know, gee, I saw that photograph trending as well. If you want to see more tweets from Sunday's rallies, you can use the hashtag in Twitter, hashtag SaveHealthcare. Tell me, what else is trending out there?
A controversial megachurch bishop, Eddie Long, passed away Sunday at the age of 63. He was struggling with cancer, and the controversy surrounding the bishop came 7 years ago when four men accused him of sexual misconduct. While some people are saying, "Who are we to judge?" and "Don't speak ill of the dead," other people are saying victims of sexual abuse must speak up and defend themselves.
Okay, I see there. Tell us what's trending outside the U.S.
Yep, this one is from China. Zhu Yuguang, who invented a romanization system for standard Chinese, passed away at the age of 111. He created Pinyin, which increased literacy for native Mandarin speakers and also for non-native learners. China's People's Daily got more than 2,000 likes as a form of condolences on their tweet about Zhou's death. That's all for me today. Back to you.
Hey, listen, thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA _IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to Harvard astronomers, it appears that our Milky Way is stealing stars from a nearby satellite galaxy. Fresh research based on computer models suggests that 5 or 6 of the farthest known stars in the Milky Way have been yanked from the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy. These stars, located just outside of the Milky Way's spiral, are about 300,000 light-years from Earth. There are dozens of these mini-satellite galaxies, like the Sagittarius dwarf, that surround the Milky Way. Scientists say that since the beginning of the universe, they have circled our galaxy several times. As they do, the Milky Way's tidal gravity tugs on the smaller galaxies and pulls them apart like taffy. This allows their stars to migrate toward our galaxy in streams that can reach as far as 1 million light-years in length from the center of the Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. You know, these cold winter days and nights are always a good time to head to the movies if you can. There are a lot of new releases in the theaters. And Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard has some reviews for International Edition's Lori London, beginning with a good old-fashioned gangster movie starring Ben Affleck.
We do, and right now his brother Casey is stealing the spotlight this year with Manchester by the Sea, winning every major award for acting, and he's on his way to an Oscar, I'm sure. But Ben made this movie. He directed this film, Live by Night, it's set in the Roaring Twenties and Prohibition, and he's the son of a Boston police superintendent that he moves into a life of crime, and he moves to Florida. Remember the term, the real McCoy? Because they were rum runners down there. So he's a very powerful mob boss trying to, you know, make a buck by selling rum. Ben Affleck directed this too. It's kind of a messy, unfocused movie. It looks fantastic, but it just never sparks. It never takes off.
Hmm.
It just feels like the bones of a really good movie. So everything's in place to be a fantastic film, but it just doesn't catch fire. It's not a horrible film, but you're just like waiting for the movie to take off. And unfortunately, it's been sitting on the shelf for a couple of years, and now they just kind of threw it out into theaters. But you know what? I kind of enjoyed it, but for the wrong reasons. But if you want to see Ben Affleck, you know, just be a true movie star, it's called Live by Night.
Well, sounds like a little bit disappointing. But then we've got Monster Trucks. That sounds like a not a chick flick.
It's not. It's from Nickelodeon Films and from Paramount Pictures. We have a family film.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, of course. So it's about this teenager in high school who designs monster trucks, you know, for racing and off-road stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And a monster shows up that's been living in the oil fields of North Dakota. And, of course, the government's after this creature. It's almost like an E.T. meets monster trucks, like a demolition derby. So this creature can control his car, control the speed. They bond just like Elliot did with E.T., and it's about trying to get him back home to his own kind. So it's got action. It's got, you know, laughs. It's got everything every kid will love. And with Nickelodeon's stamp on it, it's just family fun all around.
Wow, that's great. And for those people that just love going to the movies and getting scared, we've got Bye Bye Man.
Well, you know, in January and February, we always have horror films now. And this is the Bye Bye Man. It is rated PG-13, which I'm kind of surprised because it's got terror, horror violence, bloody images, you know, really kind of crazy stuff. And this, we have a whole new, you know, villain in the horror lexicon, the Bye Bye Man, who shows up if you say his name. So the tag for the movie is Don't Think It, Don't Say It. It's almost like Bloody Mary or, Candyman. Unfortunately, you know, it's really bad.
Really?
Because it's not, the first hour of the movie, it sets everything up, but we don't know the origins of the Bye Bye Man. We don't know why he's there doing it. We don't understand anything when these three teenagers that play, these college kids, you know, the movie doesn't have any structure. It doesn't have any comprehension whatsoever. And in fact, the last 30 minutes of this movie, the audience I was with was laughing. So that's not a good sign in a horror film when you're seeing such implausible things. So Bye Bye Man is one of the worst films of the year, and it's only a few weeks into 2017. Skip it.
Yeah, indeed. And people wonder why I don't go to the movies anymore. That's Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find more full reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. He was speaking with my colleague Lori London. Well, some sad news out of Great Britain. Lord Snowden, former husband of Britain's Princess Margaret, has died. That was peacefully at his home. He was 86. Snowden was born Anthony Armstrong Jones. He was a famous photographer. He married the princess in 1960, the first ever televised royal wedding. He had a lot of pursuits, but he was particularly committed to social causes. He once talked about his avocation.
I said in a book I did on London in 1958, I think photographs should be simple. Make people react, to laugh, to cry, but not to wince, I hope. Now, those photographs of social problems mustn't be those taken by voyeurs, nor must they be taken by somebody who's trying to do-gooder. They're just showing, hopefully with a certain amount of love and understanding, what's going on in the world.
That's right, Lord Snowden dead at 86. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We're hoping everyone has a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On the third Monday of each January, Americans honor the memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King, a Baptist minister from the southern state of Alabama, was a leader in the U.S. civil rights movement, advocating social change through nonviolent means. On January 15th, he would have celebrated his 88th birthday. Believing that change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle, Dr. King organized and participated in mass action boycotts, sit-ins, peaceful marches, and other nonviolent acts of civil disobedience. Dr. King once stated that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. And so activists sometimes deliberately, but peacefully and respectfully, broke laws aimed at segregating the white citizenry from the non-white, thus hoping to bring attention to the inherent unfairness of such legislation. Thus, when a black seamstress named Rosa Parks broke the law in Montgomery, Alabama, by refusing to give up her seat on a bus to a white passenger and subsequently was jailed for her transgression, her plight generated national attention and increasing sympathy for her cause across the country. Dr. King was 39 years old when he died by an assassin's bullet on April 4, 1968, but his legacy lives on. In the fullness of time, segregationist laws were repealed. Discrimination is a legally punishable and punished offense. And even as we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and enormous contribution to society, Barack Obama, the first ever African-American U.S. president, is just finishing his second term in office. I never thought in my lifetime that I would see one of us aspiring to the head of our nation, said Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest sister, Dr. Christine King Ferris. Mr. Obama leading us toward the presidency is like the promised land for us. Dr. King's life is well summed up in his own words. The quality, not the longevity of one's life, is what is important.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.